KaiserNetwork.org.
My name is Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform. And on behalf of our chairman, Jay Rockefeller, our vice chairman, Bill Frist, and the rest of our board, I want to welcome you to a program on that dirty little secret of American social policy, that is the large and growing number of Americans who lack health insurance. Census Bureau tells us that the number went up again last year. So did the percentage without coverage. And the picture for children is especially disheartening. You're going to hear a lot more about the specifics of that in the next hour and 45 minutes. What's more, the increase comes at a time of a relatively strong economic growth. It appears, at least for health coverage purposes, that a rising tide can swamp some boats. Our partner in today's program is the Kaiser Family Foundation's Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured. We're happy to have Diane Rowland, who's both the Executive Vice President of the Foundation and the Executive Director of the Commission, and you'll hear from her presently. Let me just do a little housekeeping, if I can, before we do that. Background information in your packets, including the slides from the speakers who have them. If you're watching on C-SPAN and have a computer with internet access, you'll be able to follow along during the presentations by going to our website, allhealth.org, and clicking on the link to the 46 million and counting briefing that you'll see there on the homepage. By tomorrow, you'll be able to watch a webcast of this session on KaiserNetwork.org. You'll get all of the materials posted there as well and on our website. And in a few days, you'll have a transcript of the briefing on both websites. At the appropriate time, I ask you to fill out those green question cards and come to the microphones with your questions. And at the end, don't forget to pull out those blue evaluation forms and fill them out so that we can make these briefings better for you the next time. Only one other thing, as a courtesy to our speakers and to each other, would you take the time now to shut off your cell phones and pagers or mute them or do whatever you can to make sure that you're the only one who knows that it's going off. Thank you. As I noted, we have with us Diane Rowland, who's not only the director of the commission and the foundation executive, but one of the most respected and sought out analysts in healthcare in the country. And we're very pleased to have you with us this afternoon, Diane.
Thank you, Ed, and thank all of you for coming and once again listening to us talk about the uninsured. It seems that this issue is an annual one because each year we watch the number of the uninsured grow, and each year we seem unable to address this overwhelming problem. What we are doing today, though, I think, is to provide some insight into some of the challenges that we face in trying to address the growing uninsured problem. We're looking at what's leading to increases in the uninsured, what's happening to employer-based coverage. And I know we'll consider in our discussion some of the implications for public programs, for safety net providers, and in fact for the entire healthcare system and our overall healthcare costs as a nation. I'm really pleased that we're able to provide you as background today some updated materials, the new primer on the uninsured that the Commission has put out, along with the two analyses prepared for the Commission by the researchers that you'll hear from today from the Urban Institute, one analyzing why the number of the uninsured continued to increase despite the rebounding of our economy and better economic times, and the second, an assessment of the change in employer-based coverage from 2001 to 2005. I think both of these studies are very critical to our understanding of what's going on with employer-based coverage, the mainstay of our health insurance system, but also has implications for the gaps we're asking public programs to fill. So I'm delighted that we have such a good program in terms of both two excellent papers for presentation along with two great discussants. Thank you.
Thanks, Diane. And you're absolutely right. It's a terrific panel. Let's get right to it if we can. Let's hear first from John Holohan, who's the director of the Urban Institute's Health Policy Center, one of the town's most respected health policy analysts, and as Diane mentioned, the author of one of the papers that's being released today. The one that asks and pretty much answers the main question on the agenda, which is why did the number of uninsured continue to increase? John, what's the story?
Well, we'll try to answer that. Thanks, Ed and Diane. The paper looks at what happened to the change in coverage in the past year, that is between 2004 and 2005, and then attempts to put 2005 in the context of the previous 5 years or the entire decade. And essentially the story is that employer-sponsored insurance rates continue to decline, but at a slower rate than they had before, even after the economy improved roughly around 2003. The key findings from the past year are that the number of uninsured increased by 1.3 million from 44.8 million to 46.1. This overall, over the entire five-year period, is about an increase of about 7 million. That is 7 million since 2000. Adults accounted for 1 million of the increase in the past year. 1.1 million were from low-income families. That is below 200% of the federal poverty line, which is about $40,000 a year for a family of four. The uninsured grew in 2005 primarily because of the continued decline in employer-sponsored insurance, which, as I said, has declined throughout this decade, but at a little bit slower rate in the last couple of years, but nonetheless continued to decline and drove the ultimate finding. Unlike earlier years in this decade, there was no increase in Medicaid and SCHIP coverage to offset the employer-sponsored insurance decline, thus both the uninsurance rate and the number of uninsured increased in the past year. The declines in employer-sponsored insurance were greatest among children from low and middle-income families, and these changes created an increase of 300,000 uninsured children, reversing the small gain that had occurred in the previous 4 years. The next part of the paper looks at the issue of did things change, or how did things change in the last 2 years as opposed to 2000-2003. That is an important change in what happened in the economy during this period. If you look at the data, real GDP up through 2003 was essentially flat, but then grew by 3% in 2004 and 2% in 2005. Unemployment continued to increase up through 2003 and then fell. What this chart shows is the same picture in a little bit different way. From 00 to 03, there was an increase in the population of 7.6 million, but an increase of only 100,000 in the number of people living in a family with at least one full-time worker. There was an increase of 2.2 in people living in households with a part-time worker and 5.4 million in a household or a family, that is, with no workers. And you can see that that changed fairly dramatically in 03, where you get a big increase in the number of people in a family with at least one full-time worker, no change in part-time workers, some small increase in number of people with no workers. So the issue is, how did this change, this economic turnaround, affect the change in employer-sponsored insurance? And the next couple of slides sort of show you that. And I need to stop and say, how do you go about reading this chart? It says it's percentage point changes, and everything in those three sets of bar graphs are percentage point changes in coverage. They look small, but they are really big. A percentage point change for the non-elderly population is 2.6 million people. That's point number one. The second is that the percentage point changes need to be offsetting. So if you get a 1 percentage point drop in employer-sponsored insurance, it needs to be dropped off, offset by an increase in some other form of coverage, or else the uninsurance rate will increase. And the next point is that all of those numbers should balance out to zero. They do not on these charts, because we left out Medicare, CHAMPIS, private non-group coverage, smaller form kinds of coverage that don't change a lot. But what this is says, what this is telling you, between 00 and 03, now this is 3 years of data together, so it would expect it to be a bit larger, is you saw a drop of 3.9 percentage points in the rate of employer-sponsored insurance. That is, it fell from 67.8% to 63.9% just in those 3 years. It was offset to a small degree by an increase in public coverage, but not enough to keep the uninsurance rate from going up. So the population grew overall in the bottom bars there by 7.6 million, And between the increase in population and increase in the uninsurance rate, the number of uninsured increased by 5.1 million. In the next year, when the economy starts to turn around, the drop in employer coverage is less. Medicaid offset some of that. The increase in the uninsurance rate was not statistically significant. And we ended up, largely because of population growth, with an increase of 800,000 more uninsured. In the past year, we get a drop in employer-sponsored insurance, no change in public coverage, and as a result, the uninsurance rate ticked up, and resulting in a jump up, a bit higher jump in 05 than in 04 in the number of uninsured. That is an increase by 1.3 million. If we put a slide here that, and it's in the chart, of what happened to people below 200% of the poverty line, you'd see a somewhat similar picture, although a little bit more dramatic. But what I wanted to focus on is what happened to low-income children, because there it's a little different. What happened there is that there was an between 00 and 03, a drop of over five percentage points in employer-sponsored insurance, but this was more than offset by the growth in public coverage. And as a result, the percentage of children without coverage fell by 1.6 percentage points. But the number of children overall was growing enough that you don't see an increase in the number of uninsured kids. Another way of saying that is if the overall number of children hadn't increased, the number of uninsured children would have fallen. In the next year, 04, there's not a significant change in employer coverage. But Medicaid seems to increase, uninsured rate seems to fall. They're not statistically significant in the overall population. They are for the group between 100 and 200% of the federal poverty line, both the increase in Medicaid and the decline in employer-sponsored insurance. In 05, though, a major thing happened. The rate of employer-sponsored insurance for children fell by more. There was no increase in public coverage for this for kids, and the uninsured rate increased. And the number of uninsured children there at the bottom increased by 300,000. And this, as I said earlier, pretty much offset all of the gains in the previous 4 years. Right. Okay. In the packet, we found late last night that there was a mistake and that the 1.6% change there was shown as a positive change. It was actually a decline, and we corrected it for the slides, but not in time to get it in your packets. So where does this, where are we likely to go with this? Will the declines in employer-sponsored insurance continue? I think it's likely. The Kaiser HRET survey that was released in the last few weeks showed once again that premiums are growing faster than wages by about twofold. Also faster than the underlying inflation rate. Premiums went up by 7.7%, wages 3.8%. And that's a factor, and that seems likely to continue. But there are also changes in where we as Americans work and where we live that are also driving the rate of employer-sponsored insurance down. And what this chart shows is over the last 5 years, what happened to employment. There was an increase of 1.7 million people who are self-employed, increase of 2.3 million who were working in small firms, only a small increase in medium-sized firms and actually a decline in large firms. This started to turn around a little bit in the past year, but over the five-year period, this is the picture. And why that's significant is that it means that we're moving towards places of work where we're less likely to have employer coverage and more likely to be uninsured, and away from those larger firms where the rates of employer-sponsored insurance are greater. Another way of looking at this is by industry, and here we classified industries by the rate of employer-sponsored insurance in 2000, and the high ESI industries are manufacturing, finance, government. Low ESI industries are service, construction, agriculture, industries like that. And so here you can see that the growth in jobs is really in these low ESI industries, as we call them. And there's actually a drop in those industries that are more likely to offer coverage. So you can see that we're moving towards work where ESI rates are much lower, 64% versus 83%, and uninsurance rates are higher. One other thing that's not on these slides that I'll mention is that the population is also shifting towards the South and the West, where the same things are true. Employer-sponsored insurance rates are lower, uninsurance rates are higher. So all of those demographic changes together with the growth in premiums relative to wages are not a good indication that the system is not doing anything other than what we've seen, and that is continue to deteriorate a bit, although presumably at a slow rate. So to sum up, if I can get that back, that despite the improving economy after 2003, the share of Americans with employer-based coverage continued to decline. In the last year, Medicaid and SCHIP did not offset that drop, and as a result, there was an increase in the number of uninsured. A large majority of the 1.3 million uninsured were adults. Most were from low-income families. The new thing that had changed in the past year is that the number of uninsured children increased, and particularly in the places where the declines in employer-sponsored insurance were greatest, that is between 100 and 200% of poverty, and in the middle-income group, between 200 and 400% of poverty. And with that, I'll stop and just move along.
Yes, thank you, John. Next, we're going to hear from Bowen Garrett, senior researcher at the Health Policy Center that John directs. He's also one of the authors of the other new study in your packets that Diane mentioned, the one that examines the relationship between the uninsured and the trends in employer-sponsored coverage. He's got a long string of research interests that are recorded in the biographical information in your packets, a lot of mental health background, and he's done more than a decade's work on the uninsured, and we're pleased to have you to your first Alliance briefing. Bo?
Thank you, Ed, and thank you, Diane, for the introductions. I'd also like to thank... The Alliance for Health Reform and the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured for organizing this session. And I should acknowledge my co-authors on this research, Lisa Clemens, a colleague at the Urban Institute, and Catherine Hoffman at the Kaiser Commission. In this research, we take a somewhat narrower view than the work that John just presented. We focus strictly on employees in the slides that I'm going to be presenting. We look at changes from 2001 to 2005. By focusing on employees, we exclude from our analyses the self-employed. And we also focus on adults age 19 to 64 and exclude full-time students. Our first finding is that employer-sponsored insurance rates fell from 81% in 2001 to 77% in 2005. And what this study tries to do is get behind that number and report the reasons for that decline in employer-sponsored coverage. And we're looking at the reasons. We're particularly focusing on changes in employers sponsoring health benefits to their employees, whether those employees in sponsoring firms are eligible for benefits. Sometimes a firm may offer to some workers but not offer to all workers, such as new workers or part-time workers. And we also, employees who have an offer of coverage, we look at whether they participate or take up that coverage. And then we look at how these reasons differed by age and firm size and income. And I should just point out quickly that these data are from a combined file that's nationally representative from the February and March CPS, which allows us to look at this time period, which are the two most recent time periods we're able to examine to dig into the reasons for the decline in ESI. So underlying these changes in health insurance were significant changes in the country's workforce, some of which John has already discussed. So I'll just briefly go over a few more. 1.4 million people became unemployed over this period, while 5 million people left the labor force altogether from 2001 to 2005. And while the number of workers grew with the population, most of that growth is attributable to poor workers. 1.8 million of the 2.2 million growth. People moved to jobs in smaller businesses, and more people became self-employed. And all of these changes tended to reduce the number of insured. This slide looks at the extent to which that fall in ESI coverage was picked up by changes in other types of coverage. And what we see here is that for Medicaid and other public coverage, there wasn't really much of a change, only a 0.5 percentage point increase, whereas the fall for employer-sponsored coverage was 4 percentage points. Likewise, for private individual or non-group coverage, the fall was only there was only an increase of about half of a percentage point. As a result, the uninsured rate increased. So the fall in ESI is translating directly into an increase in the number of uninsured, to the point where by 2005, there were 17% of employees were uninsured. This next slide presents our main finding, which is the breakdown of how that change in ESI coverage among employees. And what we find is that 48%, so the main single reason for the decline, was due to fewer employers sponsoring coverage, or rather, fewer workers working in employees working for employers who sponsor coverage. The second largest reason was that employees were less likely to take up the coverage that they were offered. And that affected about a little more than a quarter of workers. The two smallest reasons were loss due to lower eligibility for coverage among employees, and lastly, loss due to coverage as a dependent for employees who didn't have their own ESI coverage. Now, these changes did not happen uniformly for different types of workers. So we look at workers by their income levels, specifically employees by their income levels. And what we see on this slide is that there are very large differences by income. In general, lower income workers with incomes below the poverty level were much less likely than higher income workers to have coverage, and that was true in both years. The poverty level is about $20,000, or a little bit shy of that, in 2005 for a family of four. So the first pair of bars are very low income people. The next pair of bars are what I refer to as near poor individuals with incomes between 100% and 200% of the federal poverty level. And then the middle income workers and higher income workers. And what we see here is that there were initial gaps by income in the levels of ESI coverage, but those gaps became worse over this time period. And what we see is that for the poorest worker employees, there was a fall by 6 percentage points, and that was also true for near poor employees, while middle income employees had experienced a 4% decline, and the highest income category that we look at, there was virtually no decline in ESI coverage. Now, this slide looks at the reasons for the decline in ESI among employees by these same income categories. Specifically, we look just in this figure at employer sponsorship and employee take-up rates. And what we see is that for the poorest employees and also for the near poor employees, there were very large drops due to employer sponsorship of about 3 percentage points. Now, the near poor employees experienced a little bit of a less of a drop due to falling take-up rates. For middle income employees, the fall was somewhat lower, but it was equally attributable to lower sponsorship and lower take-up. And to the extent there was any decline for the higher income employees, it was exclusively due to sponsorship changes, not take-up changes. Now, in the policy brief that's in your packet, we go through findings like we just did for income, also by age and by firm size. So I'll just briefly mention some of those findings now. By employer size, the largest declines were among employees and firms with fewer than 25 workers, and most of the decline for workers in small firms was due to sponsorship. Very little change in take-up for those workers. By employee age, the largest declines were among younger adults aged 19 to 34. And for those younger employees, the declines were due both to lower sponsorship and to lower take-up. And in a forthcoming full report, we provide further analyses that look at differences by other characteristics. Okay, to wrap it up, ESI coverage fell from 81% in 2001 to 77% in 2005. The main reason was that fewer employees worked for businesses sponsoring health benefits. These declines were deepest among poor and near poor employees, employees in small firms, and employees under age 35. And the last point is based on projections that healthcare costs and therefore premiums are likely to continue to grow faster than family incomes. And if that comes to pass, we can expect further declines in job-based coverage and a continuation of the trends that we've provided here. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Bo. Now we'll get some perspective on these rather stark facts that you've seen laid out from a couple of different points of view. First, we'll hear from Charles N. Kahn III, a.k.a. Chip Kahn, who's the president of the Federation of American Hospitals. He's been a senior staff person in both the House and the Senate, head of the Trade Association of Health Insurance Companies in the early 90s. More recently, he's been known by the company he keeps as he joins with various strange bedfellow configurations in search of a consensus that might help reduce the number of uninsured Americans. Chip, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Ed. I'm going to quickly make 7 points and talk about the policy implications of what we've heard. First, I think we can conclude now, and Diane Rowland and I were talking before we came up here about, you know, sort of the same old song every year, and I think we're to a point now where even with some upticks over time of employer-based coverage, we can conclude that we're not going to solve the problem of those who are uninsured by the economy moving the moving employer coverage. It just ain't going to happen. I'll conclude with some thoughts about employer coverage, but it itself, the employers are not going to solve the problem for us. Second, I think the losses we've seen are in an obvious place. They're with the people or the businesses with the least disposable income, people who are low income, people who are younger, and people who run a small employers or work for small employers. So that's no surprise, but I think it's an important insight when we think about the policies that we might implement to solve the problems. And there are related effects of the fact that we have less people insured. In terms of the rubber hitting the road, we recently surveyed our members, and for 600-plus hospitals that we asked the question about, their uncompensated care cost, these are not charges, these are their cost, rose from approximately $5.1 million on average in 2004 to $7 million on average in 2005. I don't have the 2006 numbers yet, obviously, but clearly, this issue is becoming one in the emergency room, in other parts of the hospital, and these are just one set of hospitals across the country. It's a considerable growth rate, and it's having a considerable effect. And I think the public is feeling it. We do a survey every year. Linda Duvall from American Viewpoint does a survey of 1,000 Americans for us. We usually do it in September. We did it in the third week. And we have done this since 2003. We asked a particular question, what was the chief financial concern of the Americans we surveyed? And in 2003, the chief concern was losing their health insurance, and around 20% of people said it was a chief concern. By 2006, just a few weeks ago, 34%, and there was growth each of the years between those two data points. So the public is feeling stressed on this issue. Obviously, from those who deliver care to Americans, they're feeling the pinch from this issue. And my feeling is something ought to be done. And the question is it going to happen organically? Or my next point is, or does it require public policy? And I conclude from looking at the data, looking at the trends, that public policy is necessary. This is not going to solve itself, no matter what we hope or pray. And regardless of the fiscal health of the federal endeavor, the federal government, something's going to have to come there to actually make this curve change. First point. Second, my view is that when we seek solutions, we ought to go where the ducks are. It's really clear, low-income people, small employers, it all ties together. Those are the people who are both more uninsured than other Americans and more likely to become uninsured in the future. So policies ought to be designed to address their issues, which means that they lack disposable income, so they need greater subsidization to purchase coverage or get care and get care. And finally, I don't think it's perfect. We can argue about what, and this really takes on an ideological veil. We can argue about what we want the healthcare system to look like. At least from my standpoint, 85% of Americans, give or take a percentage, have coverage, and we ought to design a policy that focuses on the 15% and a policy that will do the best we can to sustain those who have coverage now, with it being paid for wherever the money's coming from to pay for it, rather than rebuilding the whole house. Anyway, that's my contribution to the discourse, and I look forward to the other remarks and the questions.
Terrific. Thank you, Chip. To round out our presentations, we have Gene Lambrew, who's affiliated both with the Center for American Progress and at George Washington University, where she's an associate professor. She served at the Department of Health and Human Services during the early years of the Clinton administration, then later at the White House and at OMB. She played key roles in the Children's Health Insurance Program and Medicare reform initiatives, among others. And she's a veteran of previous alliance programs. We're glad to have you back, Jean.
Thank you very much. And I do want to thank John and Bo for the excellent studies, for Kaiser Family Foundation for sponsoring them, and for the Alliance for bringing you all together to talk about it. But I think I am going to try to make this a little bit more interesting and disagree right off the bat on the facts. Because even though I think, you know, Chip and Diane rightly say that there's an element of the same old song going on, I think there are three notable and different and sobering trends that these scholars have noted in their studies. The first is actually what's not there. When we looked at Bo's slides, we saw that it actually is not people declining health insurance as much as people not being offered insurance that is driving most of the decline in employer-based coverage. When we've actually seen health insurance premiums go up by 87% since the year 2000, it's shocking that there are not more people who are just turning it down. In other words, people still are paying for health insurance. They value health insurance, which is kind of a surprise given the wage stagnation and the other struggles that families have had in the past 6 years. So I'm actually quite surprised we haven't seen more people not being able to afford the types of insurance that's offered. Second, I think that we have to really look hard at this statistic that we have fewer firms offering health insurance. You know, the private insurance system has been a voluntary system. It's been how we've all mostly gotten our health insurance for the past nearly 100 years. You know, if you look back on the history of health reform in the U.S. And the fact that this is declining, the linchpin of the system is declining, I think is quite important, quite significant, and quite serious. I think we need to take that very seriously as a trend of what's going on out there. And third, the fact that we saw the rate of uninsured children go up last year for the first time since the passage of the Children's Health Insurance Program a decade ago is new and disturbing. So I think there are three new important facts here that we need to focus on. I also think that when we kind of look at these facts and look at the solutions being supported by the White House and the past Congress, I think there's a jarring disconnect that I think we ought to talk about. The first is that consumer-driven health care is the answer. We've heard about what this is. It's health savings accounts, is trying to have high deductible Medicare plans with accounts to pay for the deductible, is putting people in Medicaid into similar types of high deductible plans, giving them accounts to have more control over their health care spending, but also more liability, more so-called skin in the game. Yet when we see costs going up so dramatically, the idea that people are not paying enough for health care just doesn't really fly with the public and with the statistics. So I think we have a solution that doesn't seem to be matching the problem. We also have lots to talk about entitlement reform. There was discussions of a commission this year. The president announced he will be taking the issue of entitlement reform very seriously in his budget that will come out next year. Yet when you look at these data, what you see is without Medicaid, without Children's Health Insurance Program, we would have had significantly more uninsured people. Those programs protected low-income people from losing coverage in this past five, six-year period. And I think it's important to recognize that had those entitlement reforms been in effect during this past period, the numbers we're looking at today would have been much higher. We also hear a lot about fiscal responsibility and trying to offset programs. So next year, we'll be discussing the reauthorization of the Children's Health Insurance Program, which, because of the budget rules, will cost. If we just want to continue covering children at the levels we're covering them today, it will cost us $30 to $40 billion over 10 years. We will hear a lot about how do we offset that, how do we finance that. Yet just 2 years ago, just 3 years ago, we financed a drug benefit that cost 10 times as much as that without offsets. So I think we had this jarring disconnect between we're willing to pay for drugs for seniors without offsets, but not pay for continuing to cover low-income children through the Children's Health Insurance Program, which I think is something we're going to have to deal with. And lastly, just a few weeks ago, Congress left town without fixing a problem that exists today. Today in the Children's Health Insurance Program, 17 states lack enough money to continue coverage of the kids they have in their programs today. This could mean that several hundred thousand children lose coverage in the year 2007 because we haven't allocated those funding for that. Again, the issue has been cost. We can't afford it. Yet the cost of filling in those gaps and just at least protecting the coverage we have today, even though we have this uninsured children's rate going up, is about $900 million. Less than the reduced stock option package of the United Health Plan's departing CEO. One person's stock options is more than the cost of covering these 100,000 kids, and yet in this country we have that these disconnects and jarring statistics sit by side without being angry. And I would say part of the theme here is these statistics do make me angry, and I'm hoping that we can really have a change in this. So what I'll talk about now, I think, is my views on the positive changes. What should maybe happen next year? What could maybe happen next year, and with potentially a change in Congress, what might happen next year. So with that in mind, I think there are three categories of policies hopefully we'll be talking about in less than a year. The first is back to this category of do no harm. You know, we have an increasing number of uninsured, and our priority has to be figuring out ways to stop that. How do we at least stabilize the coverage situation so it's not continuing to deteriorate? I'm clearly trying to fill in the shortfalls in the Children's Health Insurance Program, and extending and preserving that program has got to be part of that. But I also think that we can talk about the Medicaid matching rate and protecting states against unexpected increases in their costs, trying to make sure that program is stable and really trying to fill in its program gaps. There are also a number of pretty solid incremental ideas on how we can begin to kind of get at target populations. I consider them kind of the young, the poor, the older people, and people in small businesses. We could do better at covering low-income children through policies like bonuses for insuring kids through Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program, simplified eligibility and outreach. We could cover low-income parents, which we know actually would be one of the most effective policies at getting their children into these programs because parents and kids kind of come in units. They come in packages, and if you cover the parents, you'll get the kids. You could look at older adults and think about how about that population that's approaching Medicare eligibility, either letting some people buy in early or looking at alternative solutions to help that near elderly population that is quite at risk in terms of their health status. Reinsurance is an idea that some of you may have heard about in previous healthcare debates. It's the idea of saying if we're going to figure out where we spend our money, let's spend our money on the sickest people, the most expensive, which will help defray the cost for all of us in the system. That's an idea that's out there that could be adopted in the next Congress. And as Chip noted, you know, we still have this small business problem. Why can't we figure out a bipartisan way that supports covering, creating pools or some other responsible vehicle for insuring small business workers and other people in that category? There are lots of ideas out there. I would say, as Chip said, we need to go where the ducks are, and the low-income people are where most of the uninsured people are, and if we really try to look at what are the evidence-based policies to take care of those folks, it really is public programs. Public programs have worked for this crowd. We should really look at that, put aside our ideology to say we really need to fill in for our low-income populations. But I really do want to end with a little bit of a disagreement, which is, but we can't just target the uninsured, because if we just focus on that 15% of the uninsured, we'll keep seeing more people coming into that bracket. What these studies show is without trying to figure out how we solve the system reforms, we'll never be able to solve the uninsured problem. It is because we're seeing a fraying of our private sector system that we have our uninsured problems today. Say it simply, we're going to have major comprehensive health reform to really get at this issue of the uninsured. Nothing short of that will really work. I will say, on an optimistic note, I think that the policy disagreements here are not as big as people think. I think Chip is right. We have 85% of our people in some sort of system. If we could stitch together our systems to really make a seamless coverage web, we could really get everybody in. I think there's a lot of shared agreement on how we would structure the subsidies for that to make it progressive so low-income people can afford it. I think most of us agree that we should have some shared responsibility in how we all pitch in to pay for such a system. And I think we all agree that it is a priority to make sure that everybody has some sort of health insurance, that this is a goal that we can look across partisan lines and agree on. I also would say I think the politics are coming close. I mean, if you look at these business statistics, what you can see is that, you know, businesses are struggling with it, and I think the business leaders in this country are going to begin to come around to try to embrace this. We've seen this with certain CEOs beginning to stand up and stand out on this issue. As profits are now being eclipsed by health insurance benefits, I think we'll see more support and leadership in the business community for this. We've seen state governors begin to reach out on both sides of the aisle. Governor Romney in Massachusetts clearly has embraced this as an issue. We've seen in Maine and Illinois and other states real efforts to try to address this issue. It no longer is the political pariah that it once was. So I'll just end by saying I think we may be seeing kind of the top of that pendulum of going in the wrong direction, having policies that are not connected. I am hopeful that with more statistics, more studies, and frankly more leadership, we'll find ourselves addressing these big, serious issues of the uninsured sooner than later. Thanks.
Thank you, Jean. Well, there you have it, a pretty comprehensive view of what the problem has become and some suggestions on how to deal with it from different perspectives. It's your turn. We now want to hear from you. There are microphones that we ask you to go to. When you go to them, identify yourself if you would. Direct a question if you can to a particular panelist if you want to, and be as brief as you possibly can so we can get through as many questions. Those of you who would like to write a question because you can't get out, do so and hold it up, and one of the staff will take it from you and get it up here. Yes, sir.
I'm Bob Hall with the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the question is directed to Jean Lambrew. At yesterday's Children's Health Group meeting, Lisa Dubai presented a data analysis showing that 70% of the uninsured children in the U.S. are actually eligible for Medicaid or SCHIP, but not enrolled. Additionally, more striking, it seemed, was that 52% of parents that were polled knew that children can be covered through SCHIP or Medicaid, even if their families are not on welfare. With the Washington Post reporting a week ago that over 10,000 Virginians have lost coverage as a result of the new citizenship and identification requirements as passed as a result of the Deficit Reduction Act, what simplified eligibility and enrollment procedures can we encourage states to take or encourage the federal government to encourage states to take in order to increase the amount of kids who are actually covered?
Sure. It's an excellent question and quite a serious problem. There are actually the two simple areas are make it easy for families to get their children in and make it easy for families to keep their children on. What we know is that excessive documentation rules, in-person applications, verification of income stubs, and most recently, families have to bring original birth certificates to apply for Medicaid. Now, if I want you to all think about where your birth certificate is today and could you find it and could you go and kind of bring it at the moment when it's needed to get your child signed up for health insurance, it's become a major barrier for American citizens as well as people who have kind of low income, other kind of challenges in getting that information. So I think that this is kind of a major issue. We need to simplify our enrollment processes, make the redeterminations happen less frequently. We know that if you do this once a year, not every quarter, we will keep more people in the programs who are eligible. And lastly, we do know that as people transition out of Medicaid, they often are eligible either for transitional Medicaid or Children's Health Insurance Program or other means. We need to work harder on making it easy to keep those people in an insurance situation. Say this simply, that we've been going in the wrong direction in the last year and going back on what we've learned in terms of eligibility simplification, and I'm hoping that through public policy we can be more aggressive about promoting policies and also insulating states from any potential cost of those.
Yeah. Hi, good afternoon. I'm Joel Siegel with Representative John Conyers' office, and I handle health care issues. First is a comment. Second is a question. It is so important if we could get your organization to sponsor hearings in the Congress when we get back into session, where we need people who are uninsured and underinsured to testify. Because I've been here for 7 years, and I think we got a lot of members of Congress who care about this issue, but they may not really understand the depth of the crisis, because we really can't handle the calls coming into our office day after day with the worst horror stories that you can imagine with people who need care. So if you could maybe consider doing that, it would be real helpful to the public and to the Congress. The second question that I have is for Ms. Lambrew, who you seem to be an advocate of expanding public programs. Since Medicare is the most efficient public health insurance program in the nation, has a 3% administrative overhead versus maybe 15 to 30% with private health insurance companies and HMOs. Shouldn't we seriously consider the discussion of bills like Representative Conyers or Dingell or Stark to expand Medicare to everybody, because it would increase quality, it would save money, and also strengthen it and improve it so the cost could even go down? Just like to hear your perspective on that.
No, I'll start by saying that, you know, there's a means question and an ends question. And I guess that my view, the view of my colleagues at the Center for American Progress, where I'm a part-time fellow, is our number one goal, our goal is to get everybody into some coverage situation. We need to have everybody in this country have health insurance. That is our number one goal. That coverage should be affordable, meaning that we're not, you know, charging people too much for coverage. It should be meaningful coverage so that what you get is actually worth what you're paying for. And it should be, you know, giving you the access to the types of hospitals and providers that are out there that really can provide the type of care that we need. We do need to contain costs as well. We can go into that in a second. But short of that, the question is the means. Is the best mean to do that through Medicare for All? Is it through a public-private mix? Is it through a federal employees plan? I think that I personally am more agnostic on that, because the truth of the matter is that I think we often let our means be the enemy of our end. I would say, personally, whatever we can do to stitch together a system where everybody is in, has affordable and meaningful coverage, I'll take it. And I think that we need to kind of potentially figure out how do we get from here to there. It could be that Medicare for All is that plan. Maybe the winds are coming with kind of anger at the insurance companies and anger at the inefficiency in our healthcare system, where that is the vehicle. And I'll be supporting it if that is the vehicle. I'm not sure if that's the case, given that we've fought for a decade to expand Medicare to cover near elderly people, and we've had very little luck with it. But that's a political calculation, not a policy question. On policy grounds, I think, you know, if it can pass, I'm for it.
I guess I'll step into it. I completely concur with Gene's point, and I think that some of the numbers about Medicare would be quite different if Medicare covered all Americans. I think the 3% is a cheap number, but it's an administrative process that appropriators in Congress ratchet down on. And if all Americans were in the coverage, I don't think you could get away with 3%, or you'd have a system that wouldn't work. So I think having a single-payer system in this country would be problematic. And in a sense, right now, we have a lot of private coverage subsidizing the public coverage, whether it's Medicaid, which clearly doesn't pay for the full cost of delivery, or Medicare that pays for the full cost of delivery some years and not others. I think if we tried to put it all on one tab, we'd have big problems. So I think you need a public-private partnership in terms of funding, and that's even before you get to all the issues of Americans want choice and other matters. But I think that within the context of the current system, if there was the will to come up with the federal money and the new policy to sort of keep the structure that we have in place, and as both Gene and I said, go where the ducks are, I think we could accomplish the same goal.
I can ask you to forbear for a bit. We've got a bunch of cards we want to try to get to.
We have a question here. When we're talking about solutions, many have pointed out, obviously, that Massachusetts is moving forward with an innovative new law to try and achieve universal coverage within that state. So the question is there anything we can learn at the federal level from the Massachusetts experience, or is its passage and possible success limited to an environment like Massachusetts with fewer uninsured, more ESI, and reasonably well-off state and good Medicaid-based coverage? And John, since I know you've done a lot of work with the Massachusetts experiment, why don't you take this question?
Okay, big question. I think it probably does offer a lot to people wanting a solution at the national level, as well as for states. But I think the question, I think people have to want to move towards universal coverage and have to be willing to pay for it. And essentially, Massachusetts, to simplify it a bit, is a Medicaid expansion with income-related subsidies on top of that, the ability to purchase coverage within a purchasing arrangement, and a mandate on individuals, or at least now adults, that they have coverage. And there's a mandate, if it's affordable, affordability depends on the subsidy schedule. They've ended up making the subsidy schedule fairly generous, and whether or not there's money in there in the budget to accommodate that kind of affordability schedule is an issue that they're going to have to wrestle with. But with some additional money, it'll work. And I think that I have a hard time seeing us in this country going down the road towards a single-payer model or an employer mandate. I think having an individual mandate with a purchasing arrangement with generous and adequate subsidies is and then essentially putting the mandate on individuals and families is a pretty reasonable way to approach it. But the key thing is making it affordable. Without that, it just is not fair, and it won't work.
I think the Massachusetts experience, which we really don't know yet because they've only just begun the planning for it, does illustrate that there's no free lunch, that there has to be some money from someplace. And they do have the advantage over a state like California or Texas of having, I believe it's 7% uninsured or some number in that range, whereas these other states may have 20 or 25% uninsured. So I think what we'll learn from there is whether you can put it all together, but we've got to conclude, even if it's successful, that in these other states it's going to take a lot more money. And I go back to my point, that's where you get into the real public policy question of where the money's going to come from. But I do believe that it is partially just a money issue. You can organize it if you put the money on the table.
Yeah, and I'll just add two things. One is not only is there no free lunch, there is no free lunch in Massachusetts, because Massachusetts had about $385 million worth of federal Medicaid dollars in a waiver deal that it could reinvest back into this coverage system. So we all pay for the lunch in Massachusetts. I also would say, though, I think, pulling away from the policy, because I think the policy story is still unfinished. We don't know yet the outcome of this. The politics is pretty interesting. There was kind of this guillotine of the money was going to go away by July 1st in this waiver deal if they didn't act. There was a ballot initiative that would have been very aggressive with an employer mandate and other provisions in it to really make things happen. So there was this kind of guillotine hanging out over the state, and it really forced people to the table. They came to the table mostly behind the scenes to figure out this agreement, and they even took some of the more controversial details and gave them to an expert commission rather than trying to hash them out in legislation. So I think we can learn from the process and the politics of what happened in Massachusetts, which is we need an action forcing event, and we need a way to kind of hash out these difficult details like what is affordable coverage and what benefits should be covered in a way that's not our usual process through committee markups and amendments and lobbyists coming from the left and right and trying to do this in a public setting. I think there's kind of some interesting lessons we can learn about the passage of that legislation as well.
Yeah, this question, I guess, is addressed to Professor. I'm sorry?
Would you identify yourself?
Oh, sure. David Hogberg, National Center for Public Policy Research. And I guess this question is primarily directed at Professor Lambrew, but throw it out to the entire panel here. You talk about policy disconnects, but aren't some of what you're advocating also policy disconnects? And by that I mean that, during the 90s, states expanded their Medicaid budgets, they opened up S-CHIP programs, and here we are 10, 15 years later, and we've still got an uninsured problem, and based on the numbers, it might actually be getting worse. Seems to me that, you know, to keep doing what we've been doing and expect a different result, well, we all know that that's, you know, called the definition of insanity. And that, you know, basically that the other thing I'd say is I think by opening up these programs, you're probably giving employers who have low-income employees the easy option of, you know, dumping their employees off on the public system. So I'd just like you to address that, and thank you.
Sure. I'm actually going to ask John in a second for help on this question because I think that these are actually partly data questions. The data questions being, have our public programs expansions made a difference with the uninsured, and have we seen crowd out? Is the employer reductions that we're seeing exclusively among low-income employers and among populations for whom there's been a public program expansion, like children? I mean, I'll do the short answers and I'll let John elaborate, but I think that we have seen, according to most of our data sets, a decline in the rate and the number of uninsured children, and that is mostly attributable to the fact that we have, through Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program, expanded coverage. I also think that our declines in the employer-based system are not uniquely in either states that have been generous in their expansions. And in fact, I think you look at a state like Massachusetts, it both has a very generous private employer-based coverage system as well as a generous public program, and there's not a lot of evidence of crowd out there. But I will let actually John from the data talk about the crowd out issue.
The crowd out issue is a tough problem, and there's no doubt that it exists to some extent. But in the data that we've looked at, you see comparable declines in employer-sponsored insurance, despite the fact that low-income adults don't have the availability of public coverage to them anywhere near the same way that the children do. So if the rates of dropping or of losing employer coverage are comparable when the circumstances or the availability of public coverage is very different, it's pretty hard to make the case that it's a crowd-out issue in what we've seen. The other point, I guess, is, you know, you've seen a different – we've seen – had a very different experience with children and adults in terms of the changes in non-insurance rate until this past year. And even then, the increase in the number of uninsured children is much less than for adults. And it's clear that the public programs, where they're adequate and to the extent that they're more they're larger, have really offset the decline in employer-sponsored insurance. So I'm not sure that it's just fair to say that it isn't working. It's working when we really try to make it work, and otherwise it doesn't. But there is a system there that is at least holding things where they are. But the larger point that a lot of us have been making is that the decline in employer-sponsored insurance is likely to continue, and whether or not, as we go into the future, those, you know, the willingness to support expansions of those programs to offset it is a real issue that we're going to have to face.
First, let me say I think incremental programs are incremental programs and should be judged in those terms. So I think the numbers show that these programs have been very successful, albeit they were incremental in nature. And I think the Massachusetts lesson, which we don't know how what the last act will be, but the Massachusetts lesson is that if you're really going to close the gaps, you've got to do something comprehensive. And even though they don't have an employer mandate, they do have, over time, significant employer responsibility. Whether that works or not, whether they take the right approach, we'll find out. Also, I think the individual mandate is really an important building block here. Now, you can look at the individual mandate, and many do, as sort of a punitive kind of thing. And in a sense, I think it should be looked at as simply identifying the people, identifying all of us, and making sure that all of us have the bucks on our head when it comes to times for premium payments. And it's just a question of whether if you're low income, somebody's going to have to put those bucks on your head. And if you're not, if you're well employed, if your employer provides the coverage, then you're not, then the money will be there. And I think that's the way the individual mandate to me says everybody's got to be identified and we got to have a strategy for everybody. And that's why I'm that we need to sort of think about it seriously. If you want to focus on it as something punitive, it's going to lose and it's a political loser. But if you look at it as we're going to make sure everybody has coverage and that's what it's about, then maybe it offers us a model and maybe Massachusetts is telling us something.
It's clearly been noted that Medicaid and SCHIP did help fill the gap for low-income children who were losing private coverage. when these questions sort of ask us to do a crystal ball, what impact do we think the changes enacted in the DRA could have on the public program's ability to continue to meet the needs of children? And second, rather the increase this year in state tax revenues and the better economic situation states are facing may mean that they'll now bolster their Medicaid program and especially their SCHIP program. So are we expecting better trends, worse trends? What do we think is going to happen next year to coverage for children?
I think the point about the state revenues getting better is clearly will be helpful. And I think there are a lot of states, particularly with regard to children, interested in expansions or at least maintaining and eligibility levels. So you could see this time next year a decline in employer-sponsored insurance for children, but kind of offset by public program growth. But on the other hand, you know, I think states have a lot of priorities other than health care, and whether their additional state revenues are going to continue to flow into the health care system, I think, is a question that we'll have to watch. I honestly don't know, but I would think that it could, that what we saw this year may reverse, may not, though.
Hi, Alwyn Castle with the Center for Studying Health System Change. And I have a question for Bo, looking at his figure five, where you talk about 48% of the decline in ESI being attributable to employer sponsorship. And it's something that I think you guys talked about, but you glossed over, and I think it helps explain why the safety net didn't catch people in 2005. The way that it did during the economic downturn. And that is the changing nature of jobs in this country, that the new jobs are coming without benefits. It's not necessarily so much that employers are dropping coverage as more new jobs are being created in industries and in regions of the country where they're much less likely to offer to begin with. And, you know, it reinforces the point that we can't grow our way out of this because the jobs we're growing don't come with benefits. Do we have, of that 48%, I know you can't do it from the census numbers because it's a household survey, so, you know, we know that the proportion of firms offering has dropped significantly, but most of that drop has been within small firms that affect relatively few people. I mean, you hear this. I think there is this common perception that employers are bailing right and left on the employer system. Do you have any data that tells us how big is that problem? Because this 48% is not just employers dropping coverage. Correct?
You make many good points. This is looking at employees, so we are looking at what happens overall, and it could be attributable to two reasons, as you indicate, both current employers dropping their coverage and also just the churn in the labor market, what the newly created jobs are doing versus what the dissolving jobs had done. I believe that the some of the Kaiser employer survey data show that there are drops in firms, in the rate of firms at the firm level who offer coverage, at least over the entire time period from 2001 to 2005, that I looked at, and although, you know, small firms are small, there are a lot of them, and so there are many workers, many employees overall of the whole economy in them. So what's happening for small firms does have an impact on the overall number.
Actually, I might just add that I think, though, this highlights kind of the challenge we have when we think about how do you shore up the employer-based system. Very difficult to think about policy that would affect, you know, the offering of employer-based coverage short of requirements. And I think that's why, you know, there are a lot of good ideas out on the table that think about how do we kind of think through, you know, both maintaining what is out there and what people like, because the truth of the matter is most people really like their employer-based coverage, but also looking at alternatives so that people have the type of group health insurance that's affordable, offers kind of benefits they want in ways that are not going to constrict them if they change jobs or their jobs change on them.
On a different note, we are also looking at the uninsured, and we're talking about the rising health care costs. This question asks for comments on what contributes to the rising cost increases and what can we do to try and bring down the premium costs so that insurance is more affordable. Maybe Chip can start with that.
Well, in Monday's USA Today, Paul Ginsberg from the center that just asked the question said that people want more and they're getting more, and that's why healthcare costs are going up. And I think the question, part of the question over time, actually could be answered by the discussion we're having today. Within our system, there are incredible inefficiencies, partly having to do with so many people entering the system without the funds at a given time, without the health care coverage. And I think there are ways found to pay for it, but it makes it more expensive for everybody else. So I know that one of the issues about health reform and expanding coverage has always been, well, we've got to control the costs first before we can spend more public money, taxpayer money, on providing more coverage. And I would make an argument that I think to some extent we could turn that around and say that if there was a level playing field in terms of coverage across all Americans, it actually would lead probably to reduction in certain inefficiencies and a more even direct payment rather than indirect payment for a lot of the care. Would that solve our entire cost problem? No. We have driving technology. We have an incredibly expensive infrastructure to support in terms of the public enterprise and the private enterprise in healthcare. We have a system that's inefficient. We need to improve our quality. We're all working on that. We're not there yet. But I think this issue of having all Americans come to the game of healthcare on an equal footing is one that has to be settled for us to be able to finally rationalize the cost side.
I'm going to fully agree with that and just go a couple of steps further, because I think that's exactly right. I also think, though, that when we think through kind of our cost drivers, we have kind of our new century's epidemic is chronic illness. You know, we really see that kind of smoking and heart disease and obesity and diabetes are kind of our new plagues in this new century. So a greater focus on prevention has got to be part of this reform system that Chip talked about. I think we need to have more research on what works and what doesn't work. So when we are looking at an expensive drug, we know that there might be some alternative that is equally effective yet less expensive. We need to know more about what we're purchasing, which leads to my last kind of cost driver issue I think we need to focus on, which is price. Yes, people want more and they get more, but we also pay, according to most studies, the most in terms of prices in the world on our healthcare. And giving our demand side actors, our either employers or purchasing pools, whomever, some more clout to really try to negotiate lower prices, it needs to be part of the solution.
Okay. This question is, have the study authors looked at the declining quality of coverage? Employers are not just reducing coverage, they're also increasing copays, deductibles, and reducing the number of services covered. Is there a relationship between declining employee take-up and the decline in the scope of coverage?
I think the quick answer is no. We didn't. The current population survey doesn't ask that kind of question. You know, there's no doubt that the benefit package is diminishing, and but there's two things that are happening. It's keeping premiums from growing faster than they otherwise would, but it means you're getting less for what you pay. And the first should keep coverage from declining. The second would go the other way, and it's hard to tell.
And maybe, Bo, you could follow up with the other question we have is for the uninsured workers overall. Are there more uninsured employees because employers don't offer, or is it because employees don't participate?
Well, if you look at if you just focus on the uninsured workers and take kind of the sum total of where people start out and the trends we've seen recently, there are about 19 million uninsured employees in our study, and most of them, the majority of them, do not have access to employer-sponsored coverage through them through their own job or the job of a family member. So most of the uninsured are uninsured among employees because they don't have access, not because they had access and chose not to take up. This is discussed in also in the brief.
Let me, if I might add something. I think that if we look at the increase in hospital, the costs of those who come to hospitals, who receive free care or only pay part of it, we find that in the excess $2 million in the figures that I gave, that's about two-thirds from those who are uninsured and about a third from coinsurance and deductibles that don't get paid. So I think one of the things that's happening because of the increases in copayments, and I think that the increase in copayments do serve some positive function. The negative side of it, and probably with those with chronic illness, is that maybe some of them are waiting longer, they'll end up in the hospital, and the care ultimately, or some care, gets provided, but it falls back into the system for somebody else to pay for. So I think there's a good and a bad from the cost-sharing side. And we've got to be careful about where the threshold is on that. For whatever it does in terms of moderating use, you begin moderating use that shouldn't be moderated.
Hi, I'm Olga Pierce from United Press International. The question I'd like to ask is, you know, it seems like the trend has been that employer-based coverage is sort of ratcheting down, and some of that has been picked up by Medicaid and other programs that are sort of ratcheting up slowly. But I'm just wondering, you know, is there some sort of limit? Is there a sort of a core level of employer-based coverage that we anticipate enduring, or will the sort of linear trend just continue until eventually, you know, we see almost no employer-based coverage at all?
I think there probably is a minimum, but where it is, we don't know. I mean, right now, there's with federal tax policy, there's an advantage to people with, you know, middle income or higher income people are much better off getting compensation through health insurance than getting the same dollars through wages and salaries. So, you know, I think that's a sort of a natural, you know, breaking point, and unless we change that, it would sort of buttress that system for people above certain income levels. And but at the same time, that benefit is much less for lower income people, where we see the problem growing and developing.
Yeah, I think you make an important point. There really are three big federal programs in terms of funding health care. I mean, there's Medicaid, which is federal state. There's Medicare, which is obviously federal. And then there's the tax exclusion, which is really getting to be an extremely large number. And so there's a lot of money on the table for people that have good jobs to get subsidized by the government. And employers in our labor market have a lot of incentive to provide coverage. It's sort of the low-income side. And I'm really interested, and I hope we could answer soon, this new business versus old business, existing business question, because that might help us through this issue too.
Well, there's a follow-up question that really goes very closely to that, which is for Gene and Chip. What are the most important features of a tax credit that might be designed to help employers either offer or maintain their health care for employees? Are there some ways to do it that would have less adverse effects, other ways that might promote and shore up the system?
I can go first.
I'll try. Well, you know, I think there's two. I'm gonna actually parse the question, which is to say, tax credits to employers have been tried in various ways. I think there was a big experiment in New York a while back, and it's not been found to be very successful to give the tax credits to the employers. When you hook the tax credit to the workers, on the other hand, it may make that employer-based insurance more affordable, and there's been some efforts to try to do that. But I'll just say kind of the couple pros and how you design a tax credit and the couple cons about the vehicle. I mean, the pro is that, the kind of way you would design it that would make it most effective is trying to make it as a percentage probably of the premium, because we have such variation in costs across the nation You know, if you're in New York versus Idaho, there are very different kind of cost structures. I think you have to be careful about a flat tax credit and what that would mean in different areas of the country or within age groups. A young person will cost different than an older person. A person with a risk will cost more than somebody else. So I think it's hard to calibrate a tax credit in our current healthcare market. I think you also need to make it refundable if you're going to try to target it to low-income workers. Going back to the original kind of where the ducks are, I'm not sure why ducks got into the analogy, but we'll go back to the ducks. They are mostly low-income people, and so you really have to make sure that they have enough tax liability to make that tax credit workable. It should be advanced, meaning it gets to the person before they have to pay the premium, not next April, because it won't help them if they're low-income and have a cash flow problem. But I'll say the big con of the approach is that most low-income people change jobs in a year, have a tenuous relationship with the workforce by definition. That's why they're low-income. And so tax credits may not be the best way to try to get or most efficient way to try to get subsidy to a low-income population.
I think that the tax credit approach as another increment of reform, only an incremental reform, is always going to have a lot of problems. And Gene talked about some of those. And but I do believe the following is I think if we're going to approach building the private coverage, that we ought to have truth in advertising. If we're talking about an advanced refundable tax credit, why don't we just get real about it and say we're going to give certain people vouchers and then design a voucher program rather than trying to run through all the hoops in the tax structure? So I think the way to solve the problem, many of the problems that have been confronted by the tax credit, is to throw the tax credit concept out and replace it with a voucher concept. And how you determine eligibility, you know, I think is up for grabs. But then you have an eligibility issue, you have a funding issue for the vouchers, and then you have a decision to make as to how much on various income levels you want to subsidize people. I think it'd be a lot more straightforward. However, I'll get back to Massachusetts for a second. I think all these kinds of mechanisms that we have experimented with or would like to use to buttress the current system are not going to work that well unless it's part of a comprehensive package and you can see all the pieces falling together. Otherwise, I think it's only going to have marginal, that I think will only have sort of marginal success. I think that the children's programs have had more than marginal success, but it still is limited.
In terms of the issues and the uninsured rates that we've been talking about today, one question here is how that relates to ethnic and racial groups, and do they bear more of the increase in the uninsured, and what's the impact of some of this data on contributing to racial and ethnic disparities?
We looked at that, and at the end, because of the length that the paper was getting, kind of kept it out, but as I recall it, there was fairly significant growth in uninsured among Hispanics, not surprisingly. But if you really want to say where's the growth in the overall, the problem really occurring, it's really among whites and among Native Americans. It's just not Native Americans, Native citizens. And just because they're just so much larger as the base. So, I mean, it's white Native citizens that are really bearing the brunt of this growth in the uninsured, not in proportion to their overall numbers, where, you know, it's a bigger issue among Hispanics, but it's not a problem of minorities by any means.
I'm sorry, I just want to say, correct, that that's the growth of the uninsured. But if we look at the distribution of the uninsured, it's still disproportionately minority.
Disproportionately relative to their population.
To their population,
their numbers,
yes. Correct.
But not
correct.
It's still true that whites and Native citizens are, at any point in time, are the bulk of the uninsured.
We weren't able to look at race and ethnicity in the policy brief, but in the larger report that will be coming out soon, we were able to look at that, and we do find some striking differences in the rates. I mean, of course, non-Hispanic whites are the majority of the population, and so we'll drive a lot of the growth to the extent there's change for them. But the rates of decline of ESI were higher for non-Hispanic blacks and for Hispanics, and around 6% each in our work over this longer 2001 to 2005 time period.
I'll just say a quick note that, you know, I just recently was looking at all the research on the evaluations of the state children's health insurance program, and what we have found in some states, like New York, is that when you enroll children into these programs, the racial disparities become insignificant in terms of some of their access means. So it will not solve, coverage will not solve our racial disparities, but it does make a difference, and a potentially major difference in some of our disparities.
Yeah, I think just to add to that, I mean, I think in the Medicare program, there's been a lot of research, and there are tremendous disparities in terms of actual delivery of care, and we can go into all the reasons for that. So I'm not sure coverage is critical to getting into a point, but we have other systems issues, I think, in terms of disparities.
All right, Chip, the question here is, will the strange bedfellows get to agreement?
I think the more important question is, will the strange bedfellows get to a successful enacted law? And I get that one hope springs eternal. I'll answer the question.
And Jean, you mentioned some awareness by large employers of government action being necessary to help complement their work, especially as we look at the issues facing the auto industry. Do you see any movement in terms of these large employers toward being more available to discuss and advocate for improved government policy on the uninsured?
Sure. I'll just go by what's public and then by my, going back to what Chip said, is optimism, which is, you know, it was about a year ago where there was a forum potentially in this room where we had the heads of Starbucks, Costco, Honeywell, a bunch of the major corporations saying, alongside Senators Baucus and Grassley, Governors Romney, and I think another Democratic governor, we need a change. We need a system-wide change. It just can't be that we keep going along, as Chip said, in this organic way. So there have been some leaders. There's been some individual leaders stepping out. There's a group called the HR Policy Association, Human Resources Policy Association, which has last spring issued a report saying, you know what, we're the ones who do a good job, and we know we can't continue doing a good job. We need help from the policymakers. We need to engage. And they're beginning a process to do this. I think you see selected experiences, but I think we can't forget that if we go and we gauge by, no offense to our Washington-based advocacy groups, our kind of National Association of Manufacturers or Chamber of Commerce or any of these other business groups, there are two challenges that they have. Number one is their membership organizations, and they have always somebody in their organization who will be hurt. It's kind of a lowest common denominator problem. They can't lead because somebody will be affected by changing this big status quo. And equally important, many of those groups have as organizational representatives people in the healthcare industry who have even a different type of stake involved. So I think it's hard to expect leadership to come from the Washington-based groups, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I do think that it's out there. It has to be out there, because if the business leaders don't recognize this, their stockholders will, their corporate boards will. We will have to see a change in this, because they just can't sustain these kind of cost increases. Sheer economics.
This question focuses on some of the creative programs at the state level, pooled insurance, California, Washington State. What have we learned from these experiences, and do they offer any guidance toward where we might go with solutions in the future? Risk pools.
They're limited. I mean, I think that they can be successful with certain populations, but they're obviously expensive on a person by unit by unit basis. And if you could find another way to spread that risk, it would be great. But it just gets down to a matter of economics. I mean, they're successful if the state's willing to put in the amount of money it takes on a person by person basis, because these are expensive people. These are people who are sick, or their families will have people that are ill, and they're going to be hard to insure.
And I'll just say, you know, Diane and Kaiser's done this study as well, and we did a study at the Center for American Progress on this. We looked at Medicaid and its payment for high-cost cases. The Medicaid program for community-based people, put aside people in nursing home for whom Medicaid is the primary payer, insures a huge percentage of the most expensive people in this country, like 24% of the most expensive people all across the board, all ages, in the country are covered at some point by Medicaid. So Medicaid actually is the high-risk pool, if you want to call it that, for our nation, because it really does, for people who are low-income, disabled, or dually eligible through Medicare pay for those costs. So I think we shouldn't neglect the fact that Medicaid actually is serving this function in many ways.
And this question asks the panel what they think that high deductible health plans and health savings accounts will have as an effect on the number of the uninsured. They note that Jean has already expressed her view on that, but wondered if other panel members would be willing to comment. Are high deductible health plans and health savings accounts going to significantly help reduce the number of the uninsured? Are they part of the solution?
I mean, the answer I think is that they could help ensure younger and healthier people making reasonable incomes. But at the same time, they have the potential to have such risk segmentation issues that is creating pools of relatively healthy people and increasing the costs of that other people bear, that you have to keep in mind that you could see some deterioration of coverage in those other risk pools that are losing the healthy people who are attracted to these kinds of plans. So I think it's a complicated question, the attraction to young and healthy people with reasonable incomes is obvious, and their overall effect is less clear.
I think in a pluralistic system that all kinds of different benefit structures ought to be offered to people because they want different structures. And whether it's farmers and ranchers or others who are used to high deductible coverage, because really what an HSA kind of coverage is some money on, some tax-protected money in a savings account. It really is, more importantly, a high deductible coverage. And I think it depends, and I wouldn't necessarily say younger and wealthier. I think it depends on lifestyle and outlook as to whether or not that kind of coverage can work for somebody. I think for small business people, for ranchers, for farmers, for people that are used to that kind of coverage, they can make it work for themselves. And it can be somewhat less costly. You know, the fact is right now, if you look at the individual market, regardless of the HSA side of it, the individual market premiums have not increased that much in recent years, but that's mostly because the deductibles have been getting higher and higher. And the small employers that have been purchasing that coverage have made a choice, a trade-off. And I think at least right now, it sort of works in the mix. Ultimately, the question is, you know, how many more people is that less expensive coverage going to bring in? And probably, you know, not that many.
I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say anything because I already had a thing, but let me just say one quick thing, which is, you know, separate out the high deductibles from the accounts. You know, we're spending a fair amount of tax dollars on these accounts, especially with proposals to try to make them, you know, more tax-preferred, greater contributions to that. I mean, if you were given a choice between do you want to spend this, you know, I'm making this up because I can't remember the number, you know, $40, $50 billion on these accounts and the subsidies for these accounts, is that the best way to cover the uninsured? I think it's a valid public policy question, and I think there are some people who would argue that if your goal is to cover the uninsured, you know, creating these tax-preferred accounts is not the right way to go.
Well, looking at another option that's on the table to help improve coverage is reinsurance. And this question is directed at you, Jean, in terms of how would you pay for a reinsurance proposal akin to the one that Senator Kerry had as part of his health proposal? And do you think a reinsurance strategy is an effective next step in trying to get health insurance more affordable?
And the latter question, I'm also going to ask Chip what he thinks. So I think your insurance company background.
You know that there was this debate back in, and Ed will remember it, back in the early 90s or late 80s. And I think there was a big fight in the Senate between Senator Mitchell and Senator Kennedy, I think, between whether we wanted, in long-term care, to fund the back end or the front end. And it went on for a long time, and they never did a policy, so they never enacted a policy. But I personally believe that from an insurance standpoint, just looking at it from an insurance standpoint, the back end is the easiest part to insure because you're insuring against something not happening frequently for most of the insureds. So why would you want to subsidize that? With all due respect, it never made any sense to me because if you're going to have private insurance, that's what the private market can insure against. Whereas It's the upfront stuff that recurs a lot and sort of drives this movement towards high deductible co-payments that causes your price problems. Now, I don't know what the policy is for the front end for people that have less money, but I don't think it's going to help employers that much. It's actually going to take them off the hook in a place where there's a market that works.
Sure. I'll disagree in two ways. Number one is, I mean, I don't think that reinsurance was ever going to be so much of a percentage of that high expenditures. There's nothing left to insure. I think it was always a fraction of that. Two is, if you think about the uncertainty, what's called a risk premium, part of what you're paying your insurance overhead is an amount due to the unpredictability of those kind of that kind of risk. So you potentially can reduce the insurance company overhead by having some sort of reinsurance. And as a public policy, I think, you know, we probably all could agree that if we try to figure out where we spend our limited government dollars, our public dollars, spending it on the most vulnerable, meaning the lowest income, and the most sick makes some sense. I mean, that's sort of a good public policy to say, let's target our resources towards those who are the sickest or are the most in need. And I think that that is something that we probably should think about in creative ways.
Something just occurred to me from what you said. I guess I think that it's good to have those private insurers for the employers they're providing coverage to, having all the risk. I think if you throw the government in there and you want a public program up there, I might not like it for other reasons, but it's a lot more rational. If you're going to subsidize the insurers, though, the problem is they're going to figure out how to do real well in a system in which they have to accept less risk, but you're paying them money. So I think if we're going to have a private system, let the insurers do what they're good at, which is work out risk at the high end.
And then we already know that a lot of the highest risk people have already gotten into the Medicaid program because of their disabilities and are already part of the public risk pool.
That's true, but there are a lot of people who cost a lot of money. Right. I mean, in the other pool, in the people in the I don't know the data, but my guess would be in Medicaid, the people that we're talking about that are expensive are people that are expensive over time
and are unlikely to get private insurance.
Right. Whereas in the employer side, we're probably talking about people with
episodic
heart transplants, cancers. Not these sort of long-term things that in a given year could be very expensive. Actually, it's interesting how there's a lot spent on few people in each year, but I believe the data shows that over time, it's not the same people every year in the private market. And that tells me that insurers can figure out how to insure against that.
I will just counter with the example I think most people know, which is about HIV/AIDS. I mean, we do have a situation where inadequate coverage and private coverage has meant that people with HIV/AIDS have had a difficulty kind of accessing the drugs that they need, working. When they can't work, they become disabled, they qualify for Medicaid, and then they can't go back to work once they get those medications because of the limitations. That we did pass legislation in 1999 to aid them with a Medicaid buy-in to continue their drug coverage through Medicaid, but it's kind of silly to help them at the back end go back to work and not help them at the front end and trying to prevent them from becoming disabled in the first place. I think we have gaps in our private insurance system. As much as I'd like to think that they're picking up all those people and all those costs, I think the reality is different. And so we do have unintended consequences, and Medicaid is picking up people for whom you otherwise would think private insurance could do it.
Yeah, I just want to add something that I think sort of goes along with what Chip was saying, that in the early work that we did in helping with designing the Massachusetts work, we had a proposal for reinsurance that would pay, I think, have the government pay 90% of the cost at any time anybody exceeded $35,000 in expenses. They never included that, and I think now I've come to believe that they were right. I mean, it really didn't have that big an effect on premiums, maybe reducing by 5 to 10%. And there's been a series of meetings that Lisa Clemens Cope and Linda Blumberg had at the Urban Institute where insurers came and I think were pretty convincing that kind of risk they can really deal with. It's the chronic $12,000 person, $15,000 person that they really have trouble with. That's the person that they don't want. The person who's episodically 1 year very high cost is an insurable risk. And so I think the problem is, identifying those people who are consistently well above average, but not near those reinsurance thresholds, is the public policy problem that I think we need to deal with.
Before I go to the microphone, give you a second bite at the apple, Let me just say we're at the nearing the end of the question time. So if you would, you know, pull out those blue evaluation forms and fill them out as you formulate that last question. Yes,
thank,
go ahead.
Thank you for allowing me to ask a second question. This question would go to Mr. Khan, and this is about the virtue or the wisdom of increasing coverage by putting people into the existing private health insurance system. So this is just strictly academics. The second leading cause of bankruptcy in America, according to Physicians for National Health Program, is from unpaid medical bills. And the majority of the people who filed for bankruptcy were insured at the time that they filed. Number two, I owe $100,000 in medical bills. Most of those medical bills that I owe, I was insured at the time, but because of the pre-existing condition clauses in my Blue Cross Blue Shield policy, you know, I can't even get a cell phone. I mean, it's, you know, once you, your credit is destroyed when you can't pay your bills, and there are literally millions of people who are going through this. So the question that I have is, why would we want to continue to pursue a policy that's basically has failed a lot of people without examining, you know, the wisdom of that?
Well, let me start off with sort of a glib response, which I apologize for, but I just feel compelled to make to the first part of your question, and I'll answer your second part of your question and recognize it as I should. Despite the fact that that article was in a peer-reviewed journal, I cannot. There is something called the Data Quality Act, which sets criteria. OMB sets criteria for research that could be used for federal law. I cannot imagine that study would pass muster. And I have no respect for the peers who read it and allowed it to be published. That all being said, there are a lot of people who are going bankrupt in healthcare, and I can't argue with that. At the end of the day, though, I believe for most of us that a private group system in the non-senior and non-indigent sort of markets can be well served by a group system. I'm with you. Individual coverage, and I guess about 14% or so of those that have private coverage have individual coverage. It's a very difficult market, and these pre-existing conditions come in. But I think with HIPAA and the group market, if you had the subsidies, that most of us would be okay. And I wonder if we really analyzed the bankruptcy situations, situation by situation, whether the insurance side of public policy could solve that under any circumstances.
As a final question to our panelists, what role, if any, do the panelists feel the patient advocacy community can and should play in healthcare reform? Marching orders.
I guess I'll go first. Important role, clearly an important role. I mean, I think somebody said earlier that was giving Ed the mandate that they should be able to kind of figure out who are these underinsured people and bring them up here to Congress. I think actually is we find ourselves often looking at numbers and data only and not looking at the faces and the names and the stories. I think it's a critical role, and that's where not just consumer advocate groups, but the different disease groups. I mean, right now we really have mobilization around kind of people with different types of cancer or different types of diseases are quite powerful, and they could use their leverage not for the small policies, not only for the small policies, but also thinking about the big picture, because the truth is, you know, these are systemic problems that would be best served for their patients through major change.
I really think we need balance, and it's it in from patient advocacy and sort of national good and policy rationality. And it's a hard balance. I mean, if we look back to the early 70s with the renal dialysis patients being wheeled into the Ways and Means room, and that led to renal dialysis being included under Medicare, because, you know, you've got this sort of bizarre little aspect of Medicare that treats all those people under 65 after a given amount of time that have renal failure. And so I really think there has to be a balancing. There has to be a recognition of the individual issues. Gene brought up a real important one with does HIV/AIDS necessarily fit into the insurance model we have? But I just think we have to be careful about where the individual stories, as important as they are, leads us. On the other hand, we can't all be numbers and green eye shades, because then we're going to be led in other ways. So I just think there's got to be a balancing between the two.
I think we've given you a lot of numbers and statistics about who the uninsured are, why they're uninsured, and what's happening to health insurance coverage. And we certainly tried in our discussion and from your great questions to focus a little bit on where we ought to be going and what some of the solutions are. It's never been easy to talk about the uninsured and how to solve it. I guess if it was, we would have done it already. But we thank you today, and I'll turn it over to Ed, for your participation in helping us to maybe move one step closer. And we hope that someday we won't have to have a discussion about the uninsured. We'll be talking about the challenge of maintaining better coverage or improving coverage for our population. And with that, to Ed.
Look forward to co-sponsoring that briefing. Let me add thanks of my personal thanks and that of the Alliance for your participation to Diane and Rakesh Singh and the rest of the staff of the Kaiser Commission for being an integral part of putting this thing together, and staff of the Alliance for making it run so smoothly. I did want to say, in addition to the blue form, which you are all going to fill out for me, please, there was on the handout table one other item. We've just published on the web for reporters a source book that goes through the basics of a bunch of issues, including the uninsured, and we've reprinted the chapter of that source book for you. If you didn't get one on the way in, you can get one on the way out, and you can see the whole thing on our website. Remember, you can see the webcast. You can probably at 2 a.m. see the rerun of the C-SPAN coverage, and ask you to join me in thanking our panel for what was a very enlightening discussion. Nice job.